know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space. Yet across an immense ethereal gulf, minds that are to our minds as ours are to the beasts in the jungle, intellects vast, cool, and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes and slowly and surely drew their plans against us. In the 39th year of the 20th century came the Great Disillusionment. Near the end of October, business was better. The war scare was over. More men were back at work. Sales were picking up. On this particular evening, October 30th, the Crosley Service estimated that 32 million people were listening in on radios.
KOKW calling. I'm on international frequency. Come in.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store, and he promised to do anything he can to help me to get to Texas.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
This is War of the Worlds. Matt and Trevor are bipods. 3, 2, 1.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Nighthawks podcast, and we are the Nighthawks within the Nighthawks conceptual diner. Many things are Nighthawks. All things are Nighthawks. The Nighthawk time is the Right Hawk time.
You are a loyal hawk folk,
hawk goblin,
hawker spaniels. We're still working on that.
We are the Nighthawks, I think, and we're a couple of film critics who like to stay up late and talk about movies. And if that's the type of thing you like to do, or if you're listening during the daytime, maybe pretend you're doing, we are here to meet that need. And this is the final episode of Revenge of Monstoberfest. And we've got a special anniversary. We're talking about an 80th anniversary of a very special radio broadcast. I've been waiting to do this one for a long time.
This is one that Trevor's been begging for.
I think I pitched this during the first Monstoberfest and then the second Monstoberfest. And now that we're in the third Monstoberfest, Matt has finally relented and said, fine, I'll let you go off on this for an extended amount of time. Folks, we're going to be talking about the 1938 War of the Worlds broadcast, famously helmed by Orson Welles. Just a note, no spoiler warning on this one, folks. Any adaptation of War of the Worlds ends the same way. They just have different ways of getting there, and while we certainly invite our listeners to catch many of the free places to listen to the broadcast before listening to us, we also do hope to offer a little bit of context to get people in the best possible environment to listen. We might be spoiling the novel, We might be spoiling the radio broadcast. We might be spoiling any one of the many film adaptations. But really, if this is a story you're familiar with through another medium, you don't need to save yourself from this one. And you can listen with us, and maybe it'll give you a better context under which to hear the broadcast for the first time. So you make the call, but no formal spoiler warning on this one.
Yeah, we try not to spoiler anything that's, let's just say, old enough to vote, but that's not always true.
So, Matt, just off the top here, what do you know about the War of the Worlds broadcast? What did you know before giving this a re-listen?
I mean, I guess I know War of the Worlds is about invaders from Mars. Their iconic war machine is the tripod, and they are technologically ascendant, and we are no match for them. In the end, they are undone by our ecosystem, some fashion.
So what do you know specifically about the radio broadcast?
The radio broadcast was an early breakthrough thing for Orson Welles, who many of you will remember as the voice of the Brain from Pinky and the Brain.
Not quite. Very close.
Famous, famous actor-director Orson Welles. And then we had the historicity, the context we're taught regarding this radio play is that it caused a panic at the time because it sounded too much like actual news.
Yeah, the radio broadcast is kind of presented, at least during the first couple of acts, as breaking news broadcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity.
The apocryphal tale is that people heard these, took the news broadcasts to be real, and a hysterical panic ensued, and is usually kind of the go-to example when talking about mass hysteria. Recent scholars say that the panic may not have happened quite like we've been led to believe. Some people say it didn't happen at all. A couple of people who land in the middle. We'll get into that in a minute, but first I kind of want to set the stage here. What we're talking about, which is a little off-brand for us, typically we talk about movies on this podcast. This is obviously not a movie. This is a radio broadcast. Radio was happening at the same time as film. Like, they were contemporaries, especially back in 1938 when the broadcast happened. But radio as a medium is challenging to film because this is something that you can pick up and have in your home. And once you get into that initial buy-in, once you buy this very inexpensive device, you have hours of free entertainment at your fingertips. You never have to leave your house. And so radio kind of came in and shook up the industry a little bit, shook up the entertainment industry and shook up the news industry. Radio entered the scene for breaking news, providing real-time election results back in 1920. It was a watershed moment for the industry, but it really remained unseized upon for many years. And the real heyday for breaking news on radio came during the Lindbergh kidnapping. It's a fast-moving, breaking news story. It's gaining national attention and fervor in 1932. The nation is transfixed. For those of you who don't know, the young son of famous aviator Charles Lindbergh was kidnapped from his family's home and was many days later found to be deceased. And it was a major news story back in the day. Charles Lindbergh, at this point in his life, is a major national hero. This is something the country is very invested in. And the story was breaking so quickly, newspapers just could not keep up. Radio kind of reared its head and inserted itself as a force for breaking news. And this would be something that radio and newspapers would kind of go back and forth on. Measures were put in place. Agreements were arranged between the two industries and then subsequently broken. It was kind of a tumultuous time back in the early 30s. Also, we have to contend with the fact that this is the Great Depression. Free entertainment is of high value in this society. And on top of that, radio is acting as a medium not only for entertainment, not only for news, but we have people utilizing it for a political good. We had President FDR using the radio for his fireside chats, the first time a president ever really reached out like that via mass media. And radio is just kind of this wise, low-cost investment during hard times, and it provides all of these services for free, after buying this cheap device for your home. So fast forward to 1937, and this is the Hindenburg disaster. And I promise all of this is going to make sense and tie back together in the grander scheme of things. Matt, do you remember the Hindenburg disaster, right?
No, I do not. I was not born yet. No, I'm familiar with the Hindenburg disaster. Yes, it was one of the great airships of yore, and it was in a terrible accident. And then the airship industry was maligned forever after that, and that's why we don't have any damn Zeppelins.
Well, they were filling it was a German Zeppelin at a time when Germany was getting a little weird, but the Zeppelins were using hydrogen as a lifting gas. And unfortunately, there was a spark or a fire. The Hindenburg goes up in flames. Hydrogen catches fire very quickly and very easily. It was a bad time. There is famous footage, and I'm sure our listeners have seen this footage, of the Hindenburg disaster. It's coming in, it's peaceful, and then there's a spark. It explodes, it comes down, rending of metal. And there's a famous audio track that goes along with that, where it's a color commentator who's explaining what he sees as you watch it on the screen. Those two elements were not originally married. The audio is actually coming from a guy giving verbal color commentary and was intended to stand alone as a piece of audio. The film was being taken as silent film, and only later have they kind of been married together by scholars of New Age.
Up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames. Get it started. It's rising. Terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's like 400 or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the flame is rising to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the furniture screaming around it. I don't do it.
The thing that's weird is that the Hindenburg disaster, and the reason I bring this up, as famous as that is, and for as ingrained as that verbal image is, oh, the humanity, that almost didn't make air. Because at the time, radio was known to be a strictly live medium. And so even though we were catching on a record the audio of this happening, it was considered gauche back in 1937 to present recorded material over the air. Because there was this understanding with the listeners at home that everything you're listening to is happening in real time somewhere. And so it was considered almost an ethical violation to use recorded material. Where that gets sticky is we have this news program. It's called The March of Time.
The March of Time.
Matt, had you ever heard of this before?
No, this is all new to me when you were going through this before. Spoiler alert, we talk about the movies off air before we record. I hope I'm not showing too much of the magic.
Behind the scenes. So, The March of Time was a radio program that, get this, they dramatized news articles from Time magazine. It was initially intended as basically a paid radio advertisement for Time magazine. They'd put together a radio play, it'd be entertaining. People would listen to it, and the pitch is, if you enjoyed this story, there's more in Time magazine this week. They ordered about 13 episodes. It was expensive. Time was not going to renew it because they were the ones putting up the money for it. It was basically a paid advertisement. People loved this show. It was one of an early example of a letter-writing campaign saving a radio show. As a result, it was so popular that other advertisers eventually sponsored the program and basically paid for Time's advertisement for themselves. But why I'm bringing this up is there was a habit that even though they won't play the Hindenburg audio because it's a recording, what they preferred to do instead, keeping in mind that they thought that recordings were unethical, they would instead hire a team of writers to figure out what was probably said at the time, and then they hire actors to come in who are deep studies in mimicry to sound exactly like the people that the stories are about, and then present a drama of the created dialogue that is behind this very real news story.
This week out from the Massengill Drug Company go 1,000 telegrams. Warnings that 375 shipments of yellow-labeled bottles sent from Bristol, Tennessee across the U.S. 6 weeks ago may contain a fatal poison. And this week, Dr. Archie Calhoun drives all night through Covington County, Mississippi, finds many a patient already suffering from the sharp cramps of poisoning, finds at some homes he has arrived too late. And at last, his circuit completed at dawn, tired and haggard, Dr. Calhoun returns to his office, finds the lights still burning.
Nurse. Sharper.
I fell asleep waiting.
Did you see that wire from the Massengill Company?
Yes.
I can't understand. I've come from John Bird's, my best friend. He's dead. And Mrs. Penn, Ed Sullivan, young Coulter.
What are the symptoms?
Nausea, cramps. Get worse and worse, and then... liver and kidneys are completely destroyed.
That was considered more ethical back then to do on radio than to just get an interview in a can and play it later. To a certain degree, we kind of look at that and say, well, that's really weird. That's a strange convention. Why was that a thing? But we're still hanging on to it a little bit. Matt and I worked in television news for a number of years. And Matt, do you know of any reason why our local news broadcast needed to be live every night at 5? Other than just to say it is?
I don't even know if we did it for that reason. Just to raise the stakes for the PAs, I think.
And that's where we have this concept of the anchor. That's how we started being able to get recorded material in, is that we have a live anchor and he's presenting the recorded material. So it's really just a holdover from this old convention where broadcast had to be live. The recording of the Hindenburg disaster did eventually make air. They kind of, they broke with convention to present that and actually got a lot of community pushback. Like, listeners were not happy that they presented a recorded audio sample on the air. So that just gives you a little idea of the time that we're working with. It's 1937. These are the years that are leading up to War of the Worlds. Also popularly associated with the Hindenburg in 1937 was Germany. Germany was kind of up to some We had the rise of fascism in Europe, specifically in Germany. There's a lot of saber rattling going on. We had the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, the German annexation of Austria. Radio broadcasts of fighting in the Spanish Civil War are being broadcast. Hitler is demanding control of German-speaking regions of Czechoslovakia. Things are getting a little heated in Germany in 1938.
I think that's a fair assessment, although hindsight...
Where this is all going, October 30th, 1938, the eve of Halloween, the country was also on the eve of war. And at the time, because radio was proving to be such a juggernaut in breaking news, we had this phenomenon of live cut-ins where they would interrupt the broadcast that was in progress to bring you the latest headlines from Czechoslovakia, from the Spanish Civil War, from Germany. And the world is very concerned with what's going on in Europe. Not everybody's on the right side of history in this time, but people are concerned.
I mean, people are concerned, you know. Tommy Hilfiger's not concerned. Henry Ford's not concerned. people are concerned. Government wasn't concerned, and the 200,000 registered National Socialists in the United States weren't concerned. Did you know that? Did you know that? There were quarter million American Nazis who were, I might add, not blacklisted nor put in an internment camp.
Matt, I think you're trying to say something.
I don't know. Just this is just history facts. History facts with no context.
So our auteurs for the War of the Worlds broadcast, we've got, of course, the famous Orson Welles, known for Citizen Kane, which is often regarded by several critics as the greatest American film ever made. Orson Welles began his career as an actor. He cut his teeth after dropping out of school and moving to Ireland and was trained in the theater in Europe. He's very well read, was often, even in his early ages, the media portrayed him as a boy genius. very in the public eye. And he got his start in radio on a little program called The March of Time.
The March of Time.
Orson does well with radio. He does radio to help fund his Broadway theater career. He was also really heavy in working during the New Deal with the Works Progress Administration, had a specific arm for artistic work. He was not particularly hard up. He was not specifically affected by the Depression, but he was an auteur that they wanted to work with. And so he got a lot of work through the Federal Theater Project and is known for some very groundbreaking Broadway adaptations. He did an all-black cast Voodoo Macbeth for the Negro Theater Project. He did a version of Julius Caesar that was set in fascist Europe. With a modern dress, very fascist-themed, very timely. He did a version of Faustus that dealt... Orson Welles was a magician, among many other things, and included stage illusion in this adaptation of Faustus. He did a...
Wait a minute. I thought you said this guy was cool. Is he cool or is he a magician? Which one is it? Sorry, no shade intended to our magician listeners.
He was also did some work on exposing phony psychics. One of his stage productions, this is a cool one, and we'll have to do an episode on the movie they made out of this. But he did a controversial pro-union guerrilla production of the musical The Cradle Will Rock, which... because it was done through the Federal Theater Project, because it was pro-union, the federal government objected to, shut down the theater. They ran across town to a different theater, only to learn that the actors could not appear on stage because they were union. And instead, to get around all of this, they went into a bare-bones theater. They put the writer on stage with a piano. He played through the score, and the actors performed the play from the audience. And so he was known for these great, genius, cornerstone, landmark theatrical happenings. And he was doing radio to kind of fund that. And so he was getting parts like The Shadow. He would play an 80-year-old Chinese man over here. Then he would hop in an ambulance because he found a loophole in New York law that you didn't have to be sick to travel in an ambulance. Drive across town, barely make his next cue, and be on a totally different radio show. That's Orson Welles. That's the kind of guy we're dealing with. Famously egotistical, famously hard to work with, burning the candle at both ends, but everybody also considers him very brilliant. The other auteur that we have to give a nod to is Howard Koch, who wrote the script. He's a Broadway playwright, got his mass media bona fides with the Mercury Theater. He was a co-writer later on Casablanca with the Epsteins, which we've done an episode on. He was tasked with adapting the H.G. Wells novel, H.G. Wells, no relation. He wasn't quite sure what to bring to it. The H.G. Wells novel was set in the late 1800s. It was horse and buggies and fire brigades against Martian technology laying waste to the countryside. What they wanted to do is they wanted to update this story and bring it stateside. So what he does is he moves the setting from England to New Jersey, selects a place at random by dropping a pencil on a map, chooses Grover's Mill, and basically plans out the invasion from there.
I consciously thought that out, that the H.G. Wells edition would have been another generation of technology yet removed.
And when writing the book, H.G. Wells really planned out the book. He would actually hop on his bicycle and ride the country roads and the little lanes and figure out where the cylinder landed. He used real cities, real towns, and real people, and actually has confessed to taking great joy in laying theoretical waste to this countryside and killing his friends and neighbors. Koch is said to have done largely the same thing, consulting maps, planning the invasion, very meticulous about it. And once he got into that lane, he found a passion for the project. And so at this time, we've got our director, we've got our performers, we've got our writer, we've got our script, and that brings us to the broadcast.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
War of the Worlds begins with like a brief announcement and an introduction from Orson Welles. He reads some dialogue from the book and starts, and then we kind of drop into the broadcast in progress. So it's sort of a fade in, and an announcer finishes with the weather and leads into a music program.
Accompanied by winds of light gale force. Maximum temperature 66, minimum 48. This weather report comes to you from the Government Weather Bureau. We take you now to the Meridian Room in the Hotel Park Plaza in downtown New York, where you will be entertained by the music of Raymond Raquello and his orchestra.
And then the dance music is interrupted by newscasters who break in and discuss a series of explosions on the planet Mars, like poofs that we saw from here. They do an interview with a Professor Richard Pearson, who's played by Welles, and with Carl Phillips, who's played by Frank Reddick.
Professor, may I begin our questions?
At any time, Mr. Pearson.
Professor, would you please tell our radio audience exactly what you see as you observe the planet Mars through your telescope?
Nothing unusual at the moment, Mr. Phillips. A red disk swimming in a blue sea. Transverse stripes across the disk. Quite distinct now because Mars happens to be at the point nearest the Earth, in opposition, as we call it.
In your opinion, what do these transverse stripes signify, Professor Pearson?
Not canals, I can assure you, Mr. Phillips.
Safe.
Although that's the popular conjecture of those who imagine Mars to be inhabited.
And kind of dismiss the phenomena as natural phenomena, like they probably think they're volcanoes or something. And the interview concludes with a bulletin from the observatory of a meteor strike in the nearby New Jersey farmland of Grover's Mill. New Jersey, for the record, lovely in parts. That's why it's the Garden State. Not everyone there is a terrifying urban nightmare. All the New Jerseyans we know are, and we love them for it. But not all of them are. Shout out to Heather Buckley, producer of The Ranger, for the record.
Indeed. Looking forward to The Ranger. Just got picked up by Shudder, as a matter of fact.
So we have our explosions on Mars, and then we have our break-in from Grover's Mill, where basically what has happened as we narrow in on the phenomenon through a few interviews is that there's a large cylinder, sort of almost a bullet-like object in a crater, as though fired from Mars, which is, you know, at the time of H.G. Wells' writing, that was what the interstellar propulsion was thought to be like. They figured they were going to be firing things from cannons. And so while they are sort of doing the initial study of this thing, the cylinder opens and it reveals a being from Mars is within it, that they're here and they don't necessarily love us.
Professor Pearson.
Yes, Mr. Brown.
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface.
I say, do you still think it's a meteor, Professor?
I don't know what to think. Metal casing is definitely extraterrestrial, not found on this Earth. Friction with the Earth's atmosphere usually tears holes in a meteorite. This thing is smooth, and you can see its cylindrical
just a
shape.
Minute. Something's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. This end of the thing is beginning to flake off. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and this thing must be hollow.
He's moving! Look, keep back there! Keep back there! Keep those men back! Keep back there! Keep those idiots back!
Ladies.
Look off! The top's
loose!
Look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Someone's crawling
someone
out
or
something, I can see, tearing out of that black hole two luminous disks. The eyes, it might be a face, might be almost... Good heavens, something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me. Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body now. It's large, and large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but that face, ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black, and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is this kind of V-shape with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to quiver and pulsate, and the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something. The thing's...
So the Martian extends a weapon, lays waste to the countryside with it. They sort of dub it a heat ray. It kills Carl Phillips mid-commentary and ends his window on events. And then we see, or hear, Martian tripods rise from more of these objects all around the world, and they get on the move, and we learn that they're attacking, that the radio station is giving over their bandwidth to military communication. So as a result, listeners hear tactical communication between the armed forces and the Martians, and hear combat.
There they go. The giant arm raised. Green flash. They're spraying us with flame. 2,000 feet. Engines are giving out. No chance to release bombs. Only one thing left. Drop on them, plane and all. We're diving on the first one. Now the engine's gone. Eight.
This is Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. This is Bayonne, New Jersey, calling Langham Field. Come in, please.
This is Langham Field. Go ahead.
Eight Army bombers in engagement with enemy tripod machines over Jersey Flats. Engines incapacitated by heat ray. All crash.
After a few short battles back and forth with heavy human casualties, very few on the Martian side, although we do, interestingly, manage to damage a few of the tripods. We listen as one of the last surviving anchors broadcasts from atop the CBS building. He describes the oncoming heat rays and poison gas that precede the Martians. We hear this anchor die on air, and then nothing. And there's a commercial break.
Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. 100 yards away. It's 50 feet.
I'm Bryn.
Hi, this is Charity.
And this is the place where we talk to each other about true crime happenings from all around our home state of Utah.
I do the research, she drinks wine and clutches her pearls. Listen along as we tell the fascinating tales of real-life people who turned our communities upside down.
And tell the stories of the victims, survivors, and families affected in their wake. Because we love a good mystery, we love a good story, and because this is the place where it happened.
This is the place as a proud member of the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network.
The final act is a first-person narrative where it's more clearly fictional, and it's from Pearson, who we learn survives the attack. He follows the path of destruction from Jersey back to New York, and then it's like a post-apocalyptic, almost Last Man on Earth, almost shades of I Am Legend. You know, it's him walking around the empty city. He finally meets another survivor, and the other survivor, like, he's really, like, his thought is to actually wrest a tripod away from a Martian and resisting from the subways under New York. Specifically, he is kind of a eugenic picture of his resistance, and that he'll get the strongest humans. They'll take the tripods away from the Martians, and he says, he's chilling when he describes it. He says, we'll turn it on Martians, we'll turn it on humans.
May not be so much we have to learn before. Listen, just imagine this. Four or five of their own fighting machines suddenly start off. Heat rays right and left. Not a Martian in them. Not a Martian in them, see? But men. Men who've learned the way how. May even be in our time. Gee. Imagine having one of them lovely things with a heat ray wide and free. We'd turn it on Martians. We'd turn it on men. We'd bring everybody down on their knees.
That's your plan.
You. Me. More of us. We'd own the world.
I see.
Hey. Hey, what's the matter? Where are you going?
Not to your world. Bye, stranger. Well, after parting with the artilleryman, I came at last to the Holland Tunnel, entered that silent tube, anxious to know the fate of the great city on the other side of the Hudson.
And then, not long after that, Pearson finds a tripod, and the inhabitant, the Martian creature within it, has died of some natural cause. And then the timeline of the piece hops forward, and it's him, and they're discussing, like, seeing the tripod in a museum, and they're lamenting that, well, not lamenting, but they're reminiscing that how lucky humanity was to be saved by the ecosystem in some way, germs and bacteria, some natural facet of Earth killed off the Martians. I believe they even, at one point, one version attributes it to the common cold.
Strange to watch the sightseers enter the museum where the dissembled parts of a Martian machine are kept on public view. Strange when I recall the time when I first saw it. Bright and clean cut, hard and silent under the dawn of that last great day.
They do a fade out, and Wells compares it to a trick or a treat. Compares himself to a bit of a prankster, and then he turns off the mic.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen. Out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS.
And that's when, I guess,
yeah, all hell breaks loose in the studio.
All hell kind of break loose, yeah. It was almost as bad as Janet Jackson's titty, folks.
Well, Matt, before we get into kind of the aftermath of what happened that night, what was your first exposure to this? Had you heard the radio show before?
I'm sure I've heard at least part of this radio broadcast before. It's almost inescapable. I know we covered it in at least one mass media class I had. I don't know. I may never have sat down and listened to the whole thing before.
My mom had told me the story, the apocryphal tale of the broadcast and the panic. And I was really interested in it. And this is one of the first old-time radio shows that she bought me. And after this would come things like, oh, The Shadow and The Green Hornet and maybe Abbott and Costello or Burns and Allen or Jack Benny. Those would all come into play. But this was pinpoint zero. And she had told me what had happened, and she told me that people had gotten really scared. And so, like, I was fascinated with the legend of the broadcast and then actually heard the broadcast, which did a number on me when, I don't know, I was probably 6 or 7 when I first heard this. And it's still unsettling. And so I guess that's my first question, Matt. Does this still work as a piece of theater in 2018?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty effective. I want to say it vamped on the Twilight Zone, but I guess chronologically it's the other way around. It reminded me of the Time Enough at Last Twilight Zone.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're presented the sort of newsreel part in a lot of classes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what I had forgotten is the kind of nihilistic, the post-apocalyptic part in the last act, and how empty that gets.
It's pretty bleak.
I've been hiding in this empty house near Grover's Mill, a small island of daylight cut off by the black smoke from the rest of the world. All that happened before the arrival of these monstrous creatures in the world now seems part of another life. A life that has no continuity with the present. Furtive existence of the lonely derelict who pencils these words on the back of some astronomical notes bearing the signature of Richard Pearson.
This did not make you feel good. The way they resolve the ending, while it's pretty much on par with what happens in the book and about as abrupt, it doesn't leave you feeling good. You know, there's not a feeling at the end of this that, you know, we made it out of this and we're going to persevere because we're the good guys. It was like, oh boy, we missed it by that much, folks. There's things out there and they are coming for us. And we got out by the skin of our teeth this time. And that's more the feeling it leaves you with. And I think a lot of that comes from, I have bulleted to talk here about, there's a performance style here that is very naturalistic and wasn't quite in line with other radio programs at the time. The over-the-top theatrical style that we see in film at the time and that we see in things like a vaudeville theater or, you know, just coming out of the era of silent film. And the idea is to use your voice and because it's a non-visual medium, you have to emote everything through your voice, which can lead to some pretty melodramatic takes on lines. This doesn't do that. And as a matter of fact, Frank Riddick, who played Carl Phillips, and he also plays the lonely ham radio operator at the end of the second act. But he listened to one piece of news audio that he had on record to prepare himself for this role and get that real breathless account to sound more real. Do you know what it was, Matt?
No, let on me.
Wait a minute, something's happening. Humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks of the automobiles are spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20...
The back motors of the ship are just holding it, just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames.
Get it started. It's flashing. It's rising terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is the worst of the worst catastrophes.
It was the Hindenburg disaster. Full circle. I set something up, and then it paid off.
Did you do a callback?
Yeah, he... John Houseman, who was one of Orson Welles' lifelong producers, they had a very loving, very antagonistic relationship. But he tells the story that Frank Riddick just sat there in the practice room with the record of the Hindenburg disaster and listened to it on loop over and over and over. You hear a lot of similarity. They were going for a very verite style here. This is not stage acting. These are people who are trying to sound as real as possible. Did that come across for you, Matt?
I don't know. It worked on me. I don't know what the news really sounded like then.
Well, and it's not so much the news. It's the moments that where the news breaks down, you know. You've got Carl Phillips, who is getting scared, trying to do the color commentary out in Grover's Mill. You've got... the newscaster at the end who's trying to be the brave, solemn voice of record in the final moments of civilization. And that comes across. Also adding to the believability of this, we have a notable uncredited radio appearance here by an actor named William Adams. Now, William Adams in The War of the Worlds plays a very small role, and it's the Secretary of the Interior who is not named. The actor, William Adams, knew Orson Welles from a project they had done some time ago known as The March of Time.
The March of Time!
And the actor, William Adams, was the March of Time's uncanny sound-alike for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The part was originally written for an unnamed president rather than an unnamed Secretary of the Interior. That was a change that came from the network. They requested that they change that. And they said, that's fine. We'll call him the Secretary of the Interior. And then there was just kind of this winking note that says, you know, just make it sound presidential.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. However, I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action.
And so he did his FDR impersonation, which many scholars contend may have confused a lot of people when it came to the how much of this do you believe versus how much do you not. And apparently this actor, William Adams, was uncanny at FDR to the point where FDR actually asked him to stop doing it.
That's high praise, really. I would be like, can I get that in writing? I would want that for my resume.
So the question does come up, how much was Orson Welles involved in this? And we'll talk a little bit about, it was less from an artistic standpoint at the time and more from a culpability standpoint. But Orson was famously hard to work with, famously egotistical, and he was also famously, at this stage in the game, recovering from a Broadway debacle on a project called, and I'm not making this up, Too Much Johnson, a failed project that cost a lot of money and didn't get off the ground. And at the time of War of the Worlds, he was working on another show he was in rehearsals for that was also very expensive and problematic, and it was not coming together. And so he was actually very hands-off for pre-production on War of the Worlds. This, however, was not unusual for Orson Welles, because he was notorious for just coming in at the last minute, suggesting that the crew and actors move mountains for him, and being able to then pull it off. We're talking about late rewrites, we're talking about cut-and-paste jobs. The show is so unwritten and so unproven that they often ran out of time, or sometimes would run long. But Orson Welles was famous for also being able to feel those situations out and be able to change the timing of a script just how he read his parts, leaving the other actors to perform it as they had rehearsed. And so he was really good at working on his feet, but he was not involved in the early stages of War of the Worlds. And War of the Worlds was also, according to most accounts, not going very well. What they would do is they would record a rehearsal and put it down on an acetate record that would then be taken over to Welles, who would listen to it and make his director's notes based on the recording of the rehearsal. And apparently this rehearsal was a disaster. So finally, Welles comes in at the last minute on the dress rehearsal night, rearranges the script, and then begins directing the show like an orchestra director, and giving people visual cues, telling them when to stretch, telling them when to hold, conducting their intensity. And a good example of this is when Carl Phillips dies and the transmission is cut off, and we sit on an unheard of amount of dead air for 6 seconds, which in radio is an eternity. And that was all him. That was him holding his hand, telling the people to, nope, don't say anything yet. Don't, not yet. Wait for it. Wait for it. Wait for it. Now go. And so the X factor between the rehearsals, which is what people worked really hard on all week, and then Orson Welles came in at the end and just kind of did, the X factor between it being a disaster and being what it became somehow seemed to be his influence on the show. So it's hard to think that he did any of this intentionally because he was so hands-off at the time, but he also has a lot of experience making arguably fake news on the March of Time program.
The March of Time!
And he was obviously going for a very verite style. And so it's weird. History is not super clear on what was intentional and what wasn't. And Orson Welles was not always the best reporter for his history either. He was not always truthful. And so a lot of this has been lost to time, but what we're talking about is the overall reaction to War of the Worlds.
I don't know. I've always had a little trouble with the alleged narrative that people freaked out and ran wild in the streets. And you were telling me it was more of a consumer outrage, like I compared it to the Super Bowl thing earlier.
Yeah, actually, and that's like an apt comparison. So the apocryphal tale, obviously, is that people listened to the broadcast. Some people tuned in halfway. They failed to finish the broadcast, so they missed the parts where they tell you that it is a radio broadcast People took it as fact. It caused mass hysteria. War of the Worlds has been attributed to suicides. It's been attributed to bands of armed vigilantes roaming the hills with guns, taking pot shots at water towers, mass exodus from areas of New Jersey and New York. Now, a more recent popular story was that none of that likely happened, and that the panic was largely overblown by newspapers as a hit job on their competitor radio. This is now also being argued as untrue, and the truth seems to lie somewhere in the middle. Maybe as many as 1 million people, which is the rough estimate as to how many participated in the panic, heavy finger quotes around panic, maybe as many of 1 million people were somehow scared by the broadcast, or more likely by information that they found out secondhand. But the few stories of actual hysteria were few and far between, and by the media and by sensationalism, were attributed to everybody who was scared. So instead of just being scared, everybody who allegedly fell for it was one of these people who were running into the streets and buying train tickets with the last $6 they have, ending up in New Hampshire and not knowing how to get home. I mean, these things happened, but they were few and far between. So there's an author, A. Brad Schwartz, and he wrote this book. It's one of the newer books on the subject. Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles, War of the Worlds, and the Art of Fake News. And he also contends that it wasn't really a hit job by newspapers either. Bigger papers and radio, as he points out, were very symbiotic at the time. While you could get your short-form breaking news from radio, if you wanted to get anything more in-depth, you would turn to the newspaper. And by that point, the radio was almost acting as a commercial for the newspaper. So here's your blurbs, here's your sound bites, here's your breaking headlines, and then for more, tune to the newspaper, the Chicago Sun-Times or whatever. A few statistics. Only about 6 letters were written to Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater from people claiming to have fled their homes. 13 people did claim that they were ready to flee, but didn't. Only 5 people wrote letters and claimed to flee their homes to the FCC. So basically, folks, what we're looking at is that there were some instances of people freaking out and some people taking some, quote, hysterical action. But really, the panic that we're talking about is people being scared. And really, what the hysteria of this situation is, was not necessarily people reacting to the radio broadcast. The hysteria is really people reacting to what they thought the reaction to the broadcast was. And so really what newspapers were doing is they were taking the best headlines. You know, people flee into the street, rending their clothes. It wasn't a hit job on radio. It was sensational headlines to move newspapers. And then people read about this and say, oh my God, what has radio done to my fair city? What has radio done to society? Why are people so gullible as to fall for this? And so really the hysteria was the backlash that the fake panic received.
It's getting very confusing. This is a lot of layers.
Really, what we're looking at when we talk about people who were scared by the broadcast, what we're looking at is people who were maybe scared for a few minutes, or maybe weren't quite sure if something was real or not. But we're talking about phone calls pouring into the police station, which is not necessarily people panicking. It's people who are saying, I'm hearing this radio show. This sounds terrifying. I need to verify this. People didn't have Google back in 1938. They were fact-checking this story. They were doing what they were supposed to do. And then the other thing that people reacted to was not necessarily the broadcast. It was the rumors that generated because of the panic from the broadcast. And 2 of the big stories that came out of this, people didn't think it was an invasion by Mars. By the time the game of telephone evolved, it had become an invasion from Germany. And then the other story was that there was a meteor strike in New Jersey and that it had killed a bunch of people. Those were the 2 big stories that were running around that caused most of the panic. the panic wasn't necessarily directly related to people who listened to the broadcast.
I suppose it was a spooky time.
Well, the Gallup poll says that 71% of the listeners who tuned in stayed tuned in until the very end. And a phone survey conducted over households with radios at the time, only 2% of those were actually listening to the War of the Worlds broadcast. Overall, I think the numbers were the Mercury Theater received 115 letters protesting the broadcast. The FCC received like 350 to 400. And then there was thousands of other letters that were written in support of the broadcast from people who had read the headlines and said, this is ridiculous. This was a brilliant radio play. I fell for it for 3 minutes, but overall it was a fun time. Thank you. Which is really the more interesting phenomenon to me. But the bottom line is nobody died.
So in a certain way, it was kind of a Blair Witch or a Paranormal Activity where people are like, you got me so good.
Yeah, very much so. But the important part is that nobody died. There were no water towers shot up. Nobody stalked around the wilderness armed to the teeth. That is to say, in this country, this time. We have two other instances of this happening. It would be very easy to dismiss this of, you know, the time was right. We had the March of Time.
The March of Time.
That was blurring the line between fact and fiction. People weren't really calling news news. They were taking drama and entertainment as news. It was a very confusing time. It might have been just the perfect pot for this to boil in. And in many ways, that's true. And in many ways, the overblown hysterical panic that we've been taught about all our lives didn't really happen. But it did happen somewhere else. In Quito, Ecuador, almost a decade later, a Spanish language radio station attempted to replicate the broadcast as best they could. They were even able to double down on this because they partnered with a local paper to publish fake news stories about disturbances on Mars and UFOs in the skies above Quito. During the broadcast, military, fire, and police were scrambled, taking the play as fact and running into the hills to do battle with Martians. And as people realized what had happened and that this was a radio play and not a real thing, things got ugly. The panic turned into a riot. The riot resulted in the burning down of the radio station and a reported 7 deaths. As disappointing as it can be to know that all the cool stories we heard about War of the Worlds didn't really happen the way we found out that it happened, it's kind of like finding out that, oh, velociraptors had feathers, or T-Rex was probably more of a scavenger, or Pluto isn't a planet. You know, these are things that you grew up with your entire life, and it's kind of disappointing to know that you've been telling the story wrong. In a lot of ways, you're not, because it did happen, it just didn't happen the way we thought it did.
And besides, you get to have another layer of, well, actually.
Also worth mentioning, Buffalo, New York, during the 60s and 70s, a station up there, WKBW 1520, did an updated version of the Martian invasion set in the area. The panic wasn't widespread. It was not a Quito, Ecuador-level thing. But even though they advertised that they were doing it, and then they advertised it was a radio show, law enforcement, Canadian police all bought into it, and there was some degree of fear taking the radio program as fact. As a matter of fact, the DJ and the directors that were responsible felt really awful. The DJ tendered his resignation, fearing that he would be fired. Luckily, cooler heads in this case prevailed, and they were not fired, and the DJ's resignation was not accepted. But it's funny, when I had my college radio show, my roommate suggested, hey, you should do a fake Martian invasion sometime. And I said, you know, that's a funny joke, but really, that's not something you do. It's kind of a well-known thing among broadcasters is that you just don't mix fact and fiction that way anymore. So ultimately, Matt, we went in depth here, but there's still so much here. What are your final reactions? What did you take away from War of the Worlds?
I would say, like, there's a timelessness, I guess. I always appreciate everything, anything that makes me go, like, oh, this isn't the first conversation ever had about fake news, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That actually helps me with, that helps with the anxiety a bit. The fundamental horror of the idea of, like, the alien invader that has no, it doesn't even try to communicate, it just goes to work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think still works today. I don't know, knowing what we know of Mars now, I don't know that you could recreate it with Mars.
Well, and recent adaptations have kind of taken a tip from that. The Steven Spielberg one is the creatures are avowedly from beyond Mars, which is interesting. Matt, do you have any if-then recommendations for this?
The recent Spielberg Cruise one was I remember being passable.
I actually rather enjoyed it, but I can be a sucker for this.
I haven't seen too many of the other adaptions. I remember the series that ran for a few seasons from when I was a kid. I don't know if it was good or not.
You know, I never did catch it, but it was, I think, a canonical sequel to the George Pal adaptation. Like, the two that you really have to concern yourself with, the two lionized ones, are probably the Steven Spielberg one from, like, 2005 and the George Pal version. There's differences between them, you know, Spielberg definitely put his own stank on it. But it's important to contextualize that War of the Worlds as a property is in the public domain. And so this story has been done many, many times, often many times, not very well. And really the best two I would recommend are probably those two. So there is a made-for-television film that is about the broadcast itself, kind of a fictionalized take on that, also written by Howard Koch, based on his stage play titled The Night That Panicked America, which I think is available on DVD, came out in 1975, and is a little more based in the urban legend around War of the Worlds than it is really based, in fact, even though it was written by Howard Koch, who was there. What you're getting is kind of an inside peek into how the mechanics worked inside the theater as they were recording. And the panic outside is largely what he was told happened, but may not have been a necessarily a fair representation of that.
Friday. Movies. The world premiere of an exciting new motion picture on the ABC Friday Night Movie.
The Martians have just landed.
The radio said it was the end of the world, and the world believed it.
This is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed.
They've landed on Earth. New Jersey's under martial law.
Orson Welles conceived it as a radio play.
We are ready to attack.
But it turned Halloween into a nightmare for millions.
How could they think this was real?
It was the night that panicked America.
I also want to call out to a couple of other Orson Welles as a character films. There is the aforementioned Cradle Will Rock that was directed by Timothy Robbins. Features an all-star cast about the Works Progress Administration and the Federal Theater Project. Definitely worth checking out. Angus McFadden plays Orson Welles in a small role in that one. We also have RKO 281 that features Liev Schreiber as Orson Welles, and that's the story behind the creation and making of Citizen Kane. And also The Fascist Caesar, the production of that, is explored a little bit in the fictionalized story Me and Orson Welles by director Richard Linklater from 2008, starring Christian McKay as Orson Welles and Zac Efron in a protagonist role that, despite having Zac Efron in it at the time, I thought was going to be a deal killer. No, he's pretty good. Check out this movie.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing repelling about him. Everybody likes him. I'll throw out a recommend real quick. Not really related, more to the day this will drop. Coco is back in theaters, at least in my neck of the woods, for limited release for Day of the Dead. And if you haven't seen Coco in a theater, you haven't seen Coco.
Oh, Coco. I love Coco. I can't watch Coco in mixed company because I turn into a blubbery mess, but yeah, I love Coco.
You make me un poco loco, un poquitito loco. The way you keep me guessing, I'm nodding and I'm guessing. I'll count it as a blessing that I'm only un poco loco.
It's some. I'm not kidding. Like, pay for the 3D, pay for the D box. It is something else on a big screen.
So Matt, I think we're going to be able to stick a fork or a pumpkin knife in this edition of Monstober, Revenge of Monstoberfest. How do you feel? How have you changed as a person?
I've evolved. I've learned a lot. I think the soft spot on the top of my head is now fully formed, and I am a real boy.
I too have grown, I have changed, and I have developed a third arm in the middle of my back. It's there for partying. Who wants to party?
That's a sad, lonely place for a party arm, but you may not be happy when it parties with what it can reach.
All right, ladies and gentlemen.
On that note, yeah.
We're gonna wrap this up. Wrap up this edition of Nighthawks Podcast, this edition of Monstoberfest, Revenge of Monstoberfest. I'm going to get that right eventually. Find us on Stitcher. Find us on iTunes. Find us on the podcast aggregate of choice. And also leave us a review. Leave us a rating if you're able to do that through them. Be sure to check out the other podcasts on the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network. We would personally recommend The Box and This Is The Place for some spooky true crime Utah-centric stuff or some mass media geek talk.
And even if you just like, I should mention that if you just like true crime, a surprising amount of it happens in Utah.
Yeah, they get a lot. They're going to get a lot of mileage out of that on This Is The Place.
I think it's mostly just people trying to get to Mexico or California from someplace else, and Utah's where they catch them, but it happens a lot. But
all right, Matt, well, anything that we need to do before we bound out of here?
I think we've covered our bases.
All right, we'll get that slice of pumpkin pie to go, because we're gonna hop on a broomstick and get out of here, because it's almost morning.
Now that was a lot, Trevor. That was a lot there. A lot of
broomstick was too much, wasn't it? Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to ride on a broomstick. I want to make like maybe two broomsticks with a hammock between them. I don't know about Quidditch. I want to take a sky nap.
It's a sleeper car for a Nimbus 3000.
Oh, Nimbus 3000 does sound restful. Okay, do you think we're good?
I think we're good.
Mars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell. And there's no one there to raise them. If you did,
what are you watching?
Hey, what are you reading?
Tell me, what are you loving this week?
What are you putting in your ears?
Welcome to The Box. I'm Charity.
I'm Crystal.
I'm Rebecca. On The Box, we talk about all the media we love, old and new.
Here are hottest takes on the classic movies, new TV shows, our favorite podcasts, and what we downloaded this week.
Subscribe on iTunes at HSPN The Box or wherever you get your podcasts to hear us every week.
And don't forget, too much TV will rot your brain.
A proud member of the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network.
So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.